Welcome to the podcast series from the 8th Educational Seminar on Migration 2021 entitled Migration in a Multilateral World, organized by the European Migration Network in Slovakia. You are listening to the lecture on Debunking Migration Myths and Misconceptions presented by Melissa Siegel. Melissa Siegel is a professor of migration studies and head of migration studies at Maastricht University and the United Nations University Merit. While teaching, she has advised, worked on or headed projects for several governments and international organizations and is regularly involved in migration-related trainings or capacity-building activities. Her main research interests lie in the causes and consequences of migration, with a strong emphasis on the linkages between migration and development. Enjoy the lecture.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It is a pleasure to be here, even virtually. I'm really happy that we were able to still have this session. So let me just jump right in and get started. This session is really looking at myths and misconceptions around migration. And within the migration field, unfortunately, there seem to be actually quite a lot of misconceptions around migration. So I want to go through a few of these. I want to start by, looking at misconceptions around who is a migrant, also misconceptions around migration trends, and also misconceptions around how migration and development interact. So let's first think about and look at who is actually a migrant and who is perceived as a migrant. If you ask often the layperson on the street, particularly in a European context, who is a migrant or who is perceived as a migrant, you often hear things like people coming from developing countries, people who are poor, people who are unskilled, people from Africa, refugees, people coming across the Mediterranean in boats. So this is often the perception of who a migrant is. Unfortunately, these are often a bit more negative perceptions of who migrants are, and this perception is actually not the actual reality around who migrants are. So if we actually look, the IOM has put together the I Am a Migrant project, looking at migrant stories of people all over the world, really helping to normalize migration. So migration is a very normal part of life. So I myself am an international migrant. I am originally from the United States and I live in the Netherlands. But I am not the kind of person that is often thought of when people first think of who a migrant is. And it's really important for us to have a more holistic and better understanding of who all encompasses migrants. So at Maastricht University and the United Nations University Merit, where I work, we've actually started a blog series called Migration Stories that highlight our own migration stories of staff members from Maastricht University and within the United Nations University system, either from our backgrounds or our parents or our own migration and mobility experiences, which really shows that migration is just a normal part of life. And we see people from all different walks of life also being migrants. So here I want to quickly have a look at the definition of a migrant. And this is a more encompassing definition of a migrant. So it's any person who is moving or has moved across an international border or with it in a state away from his or her habitual place of residence. Okay, so this is a migrant in general, maybe perhaps not necessarily an international migrant, but it's really about a person who's moved, a person who has changed their place of residence. And with regard to international migration, of course, that means across a country border. So this encompasses a lot of different people, many different motivations and categorizations of people. So one of the first categorizations that we often hear about, or distinctions that are often made in migration, is forced migration versus voluntary migration. And definitely there's a gray area in between these two things. And there are a number of reasons and motivations why people migrate. So a few of these reasons are on the more forced side, or those that are traditionally considered more forced reasons for migration, things like conflict, violence, war, persecution, environmental factors. So you could have, you know, fast disasters or shocks like a tsunami or hurricane, earthquakes, or you could also have slow onset things like general environmental degradation, you know, a lack of rainfall, things like that. And then on a more voluntary side, we generally have things like, you know, migrating to be with family members, so family reunification or family formation, education. So, you know, studying abroad somewhere, this is usually happening or more commonly happening at the higher education level. Retirement, which is something that many people often don't think of, that retirement is often a reason for migration. So people moving to countries, perhaps where their money goes further, the weather is better, the food is better, better quality of life, perhaps. And then jobs. So a major reason why people migrate are for jobs. And these are people across all skill sectors. So this could be, you know, from those who are highly skilled, medium skilled, and low skilled. Then we also have lifestyle migration, and this is one that is maybe not often thought of, but we often see it for people, for instance, in their early 20s, people who are really just interested in experiencing another culture, a different lifestyle, learning about another country. And in general, also better opportunities and access to services are also important reasons why people migrate. Now, this is, of course, not an all-encompassing list of reasons why people migrate, but some of the top ones. Now, another common misconception is that there's generally only one reason why people migrate. And in reality, it's usually a combination of factors as to why people migrate and often also where they choose to go. So let's just take some examples here. So with person one, let's say this is a more typical voluntary migration situation. So perhaps this is a person who has, let's say, moved to the United States for higher education to go to university. So officially they're there as a student, and the official reason for migration is education. And that is, of course, an important reason for them. But with moving to the United States, very often what you see among student migrants is that they're also lifestyle migrants to some extent. They're interested in learning about a different culture, a different country, and living in a different context. At the same time, having been a student in a country like the United States or the Netherlands, where I live, or several others, gives you better access to job opportunities in those countries and the ability to maybe stay on and work there later. And maybe perhaps also just having better opportunities, not just with regards to jobs, but better opportunities in general. So this whole mix of factors is what makes people decide to actually migrate, not just being a student. Now, if we look at a second scenario, perhaps a more typically forced migration scenario, we could take someone, for instance, from Syria who has left because of war on the one hand, for sure, but also because of the violence and persecution and war, the access to services have also been greatly diminished. So many schools and hospitals have also been destroyed. It's not so easy for children to go to school, to have access to healthcare services and many other things. So this access to services is also another reason why someone would want to move, along with the security situation. And next to that, perhaps someone already has family members in another country, maybe in Germany, for instance, and they would like to reunify with these family members. So even in a typically forced migration situation, we often see a mix of factors coming together in that decision-making process. So it's not just one reason often, which is a common misconception. Now let's turn to a few other misconceptions, specifically around migration trends. So I'm going to go through these kind of one at a time. So let's look first at the kind of myth or misconception that migration is at an all-time high and accelerating fast. So It is true that migration, that we are seeing greater numbers of migrants today than we have seen previously. So in 2020, it was estimated that around 280 million migrants were, that we had more than 280 million migrants globally. And this is around 3.5% of the world population. So 3.5% of the world population is not a huge number, and definitely not what's often covered in the media or the metaphors that are often discussed when talking about migration, like floods and waves and things like that, that give the impression that migration is much, much more than it actually is. If we also look at migration as a percentage of the population, you know, it's nowadays it's only 3.5% of the population, but it's been, you know, around 3% of the population since the 1990s. And we've seen, yes, a slight growth, but nothing near like what is the often connotations that we see around the numbers of migrants. So, you know, around 3% of world population nowadays, 3.5% of world population, because you have to remember that even as numbers of migrants are increasing, world population also increases. So it's important for us to, you know, take this more holistic approach and take these things into account. Now, let's look at the common misconception also that most migration is from developing countries to developed countries. I think if you would, you know, watch the news today or listen to a lot of the political debates, you would think that, you know, all of migration today is people moving from developing countries to developed countries. And that actually is not the case at all. About a third of migration today is people moving from developing countries to developed countries. So in the graph that you see here, you can read south as developing, north as developed. And another very, very important kind of corridor of migration is people moving from developing countries to other developing countries. But this is often not very well known. It's definitely underrepresented in media discourse. And then another important group is people moving from developed countries to other developed countries. So people like myself, you know, someone who was born and raised in the United States and moved to the Netherlands. So this is moving from a developed country to another developed country. We do even have some migration, although it is quite small, from developed countries to developing countries. And these could be people, you know, like aid workers, those working for the United Nations, but also intercorporate transferees, you know, moving from one country to another. Now, if we stay with numbers of migrants, it is very much the case that people often overestimate the number of immigrants in their countries. So let's take a look at this. Let's take a look at some of the evidence here. So what this shows is this is some information from 2015, and it shows the actual number of international migrants in a country against the average guess of the local population as to how many people are in the country, international migrants are in the country. And you can see for many countries, there is a gross overestimation of the number of immigrants in a country. And we see this for most countries around the world. Now, of course, this is based on number of migrants, and that would be first generation migrants. So someone who was born in another country and moved to a country. Now, you could guess that, well, maybe some of this overestimation has to do with people not only thinking of first generation migrants, but maybe also second generation migrants, or also the children of first generation migrants. So children that were actually born in the country of the destination, but are still maybe from an ethnic perspective being thought of as immigrants. So let's take a look then at some evidence in this regard. So here you can see again, perception versus reality over a number of countries. You can see the actual perception in the orange bar. Reality of, you know, first generation actual immigrants is this dark blue bar. And then second generation immigrants is the light blue bar. And you can see if we take these two things together, then this is maybe a bit closer to some of the perceptions in countries like, for instance, Canada or the United States or the United Kingdom. But still, in a number of countries, even taking first and second generation together, the perception is extremely out of whack with reality. If we look at a country like Hungary, where in actuality, taken together, this is 7%, and the guess is the average perception is 15%. Similarly, in Poland, where first and second generation taken together is only 3% of the population, but the perception is that it is 16% of the population. And you have similar discrepancies in Italy, in Belgium, in Germany, and in Spain. So really, there is so often a misperception of the actual number of immigrants in a country. Let's look at another common misconception, which has to do with refugees. And we looked first at, misconceptions around where people are coming from and where they're going to. But there's another misconception around who is, hosting refugees. And I think if you would ask a lot of people in a European context today, they would have the perception that Europe is hosting a huge number of refugees and, a good portion of the refugee population. Well, this, as you can maybe already imagine, is also not the case. So here, if we take refugees and asylum seekers all together, you can see in absolute terms the countries that are actually hosting the largest numbers of refugees. And if you were to even look down at maybe the next 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, these would also all be developing countries. So in this list, we only have two developed countries that are actually hosting larger numbers of refugees or asylum seekers. And this is in absolute terms. Now, if we also look at this in relative terms, so if we look at it as a proportion of the population of those countries, we also see a different picture. So the majority of the countries that we saw previously that were hosting large numbers in absolute terms are not on this list. So these are the countries that actually are proportionally doing the most for refugees. And again, if you look at this list, there is not one, highly developed country on this list. So again, really big misconceptions. Even countries like Germany or the United States that might be hosting a lot of refugees or asylum seekers, they have very large populations. So as a proportion of their population, it is actually a small drop in the bucket. So actually, 86% of all refugees today are hosted in developing countries, with only 14% of refugees today hosted in developed countries. And one third of the global refugee population is actually hosted in least developed countries. So these are also countries that have the least capabilities to be able to host and give services to a population that is very much in need. Now, let's look also, if we're staying along the same line of refugees, I think there's often a common misconception that while we do see a large number of refugees and higher numbers than we have seen in the past, absolutely, there's this misconception that refugees are a large proportion of migrants today. If we actually look at the evidence on this, refugees only make up around 10% of international migrants globally. The majority of international migrants today are actually what we could consider them or categorize them as labor migrants. And these are labor migrants that are highly skilled, labor migrants that are medium skilled, and labor migrants that are also lower skilled. Second in line to this are family migrants. These are often family members of labor migrants or also family members, for instance, of refugees that are reunifying with their family members. So labor migration and then family migration are really the two biggest categorizations of migrants today and not refugees. There's also another misconception around forced migration with regard to the reasons for forced migration. So forced migration can be because of, things like conflict and violence and persecution, but you can also have displacement because of natural disasters. And if we actually look at figures over time, so here in this graph, the blue bars are displacement because of natural disasters, and the orange bars are displacement because of conflict and violence. So what you actually see is that on average, we do see more displacement every year because of natural disasters than we do because of conflict or violence. However, the nature of these displacements is quite different. So displacement because of conflict and violence is often of a longer term nature and is also often much more practically difficult to get resources, supplies, and aid to this group. But it is important for us to have an idea of the numbers, even though the nature and length of these displacements is also different. So displacement because of environmental factors, especially quick onset, quick shocks, disasters, often does not last as long as displacement because of conflict or violence. We do see so much protracted displacement, which, you know, has to do with displacement being for a longer term, so more than 5 years. And in many cases, displacement that's going through generations. If you look at, for instance, Afghans or Somalis, we really see displacement that has gone on for many, many years and over multiple generations. Now let's look at the idea that the main cause of migration is poverty. All right, and let's look at some evidence in this regard. That in general, the main cause of migration is not poverty. So here is some evidence coming out of some work from Professor Hein de Haas. Here we see immigrants in OECD countries, particularly coming from Africa. And the first thing that you'll see here is that the countries that are more developed in this African context, so Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, actually have more migrants than, Benin, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Nigeria, Liberia, Senegal, and Mali. But you could argue that the countries that would, or people from, you know, the countries on the left-hand side of this graph could benefit even more from migration because they are also less developed. But you actually see less migration from these countries. Here, if we also look at the absolute number of migrants from countries of origin, you'll see, you know, in the top places, you'll see countries like India, Mexico, China, Russia, the Philippines. These are not the poorest countries in the world. However, they have some of the highest numbers of migrants. Even within this, you know, top 20 of countries sending migrants, you see countries like the United Kingdom and Germany, who actually are included, and Poland, who make up top 20 of countries sending migrants. So this can already tell you something about, you know, the reasons why people are migrating, and that poverty is not always and very often not the reason why people are migrating. That is not to say that this is never the case, but that there is this common misconception that that's the case. You know, if you look at migration from developed countries to other developed countries, which we saw was, you know, close to, 20% of migration today, these are not people moving because of poverty. So it's moving because of, you know, maybe interesting jobs, lifestyle reasons, better opportunities abroad. So there are a number of misconceptions also around what I would say is called the migration development nexus, or how migration and development are interlinked. So one misconception is that development will reduce migration. And another common misconception is that development aid will reduce migration. So let's look at some of the evidence around this. So let's first look at the kind of misconception that development will reduce migration. So let's first look at this from a theoretical perspective. And let's look both at immigration, so people entering countries, and emigration, which is someone who leaves a country, right? So first, the relationship between immigration and development, or people entering countries, is very clear here. So as a country develops, you will see more and more immigrants coming to that country. So as a country develops, that country becomes more and more attractive to international migrants. Now, if we look at emigration, there is a bit different story here, and the relationship is not linear. So you can see at very low levels of development, we see also very low levels of migration. And as development increases, you would expect more migration to a specific tipping point where it will reduce, but never go to zero. Okay. So even the most highly developed countries in the world would still have international migrants. So that would be someone like myself, an American who is an international migrant abroad. So this idea that just with income or just with development, migration will stop, even according to theory, doesn't make sense. Now, let's look, though, at some evidence in this regard. So this is some actual evidence using the Human Development Index. Again, some work from Professor Heinde Haas. And in red, you see the number of immigrants in a country, so those that come into a country, by level of development based on the Human Development Index. So what you can see very clearly is this pattern that I just showed you previously when we looked at it from a theoretical perspective. So as a country is more developed, we see that they are attracting more and more international migrants. Now, if we look at emigration or people leaving their countries, here you see this inverted U-shape. So again, at very low levels of development and low levels of development, we see also very low numbers of international migrants. Then we come to a kind of maximum or tipping point with regard to middle-income countries, where we see the highest numbers of immigrants. And then this reducing slightly, but still both high and very highly developed countries still have more international immigrants than low and very low development countries. So we have this different kind of very interesting relationship with regard to migration and the development of a country. So now, why is this? Why do we see such low levels of migration at low and very low levels of development? Why do we see a peak at middle income? And why do we still see a lot of migration at high or very high levels of development? So let's start on the low and very low side. So on this side, actually, to be able to migrate takes resources. It takes often monetary resources, but it also takes human capital resources. So for it to be easier for someone to leave a country, you need to have money, you need to have networks often and contacts. Having higher levels of education also make it easier for you to move from a country. You also see that other countries around the world make it easier for people coming from higher income countries to migrate, or from countries that have higher levels of human capital, because these are exactly the kinds of people that they would like to attract, or kinds of labor that they would like to attract to their countries. So at very low and low levels of development, it is both difficult from a resource perspective to leave the country, and from a policy perspective to also be able to leave the country because of policies on the other side with regard to how easy it is to enter other countries. Now, at the middle Human Development Index, here we already see that people have more monetary resources, more human capital resources. They're often already better educated, but the wage differentials between countries still make it very attractive for these people to be interested in migrating. So we see, you know, on both sides, I would say both on the supply side and on the demand side, very high levels, which make it easier for people in middle incomes to be able to migrate. Then we come to high and very high levels of development. Here, the need might not be as great, for instance, with regard to wage differentials, but it is it's much easier for people on this side to be able to migrate. So they generally have very high levels of education, are highly skilled, have resources and networks that make it very easy or comparatively easy for them to migrate. And at the same time, these are, you know, highly skilled people that are exactly the kind that other countries want to attract to their country. So this is why we're seeing this kind of inverted U-shape. If we're also being very honest, what really often also changes with development is the perception of migrants and the barriers to their entry. So at very low levels of development, often countries of destination are, you know, doing things to try to keep them out and say, okay, we're not very interested in this group. At middle levels, they're saying, all right, we're interested. And at very high levels, you know, it's turned into a global race for talent and all the different countries trying to attract the best and the brightest. So this is really the relationship that we see with migration and development. Now, and so I showed you also this kind of tipping point at kind of middle income country status of where we see changes. Now, if we really break that down, this is some work by the OECD, and look at practically at, you know, what level of monetary or GDP development would that be, you can see that the tipping point here is generally between 8,000 and 10,000 US dollars PPP per capita. So this is a relatively high level of development before we even see that tipping point. So that means that as countries develop from, you know, least developed and low developed up, what we would actually expect is an increase in migration until a specific tipping point where the rate of growth would not be as high, but would still never go back to zero. So that brings us to another myth or misconception here, that development aid will reduce migration. So in general, development aid is targeted at, you know, some of the least developed countries in the world. So assuming even that development aid helps to actually increase development, which on a large scale and over a long term can be definitely debated. But assuming this would even be the case, what we would expect is actually higher levels of emigration from least developed and lower developed countries in the short to medium term, most definitely. So, important questions around, you know, will development aid, does development aid actually reduce migration is, you know, okay, so what are development interventions? Do they work? And then do they actually deter migration? So what are some of these popular interventions? In a lot of policy circles, there's this idea of addressing, quote unquote, the root causes of migration. And for this, a lot of specific types of interventions are being looked at. So social protection, things like social transfers and cash or in kind, employment creation and insurance, skills training, SME support, agricultural development, institutional capacity building, as well as, you know, so if you even look at the Emergency Trust Fund for Africa, for example, a lot of the interventions that have been put into place there are employment creation, you know, basic local level service provision, migration management, and migration governance, which, okay, whether or not you can even call migration management and migration governance, development interventions is something that I think we could have a whole discussion about, but this is often what we are seeing. So, if we're looking at this, we have to look at, you know, for this rationale to work, aid must be targeted and effective. And there's definitely a lot of skepticism around the ability of development aid to affect large changes. So, you know, things that would really make a big difference in youth employment. And there's also little evidence that development aid helps to mitigate conflict, which is also another driver of forced migration. So if we would actually look at development over time in the poorest countries in the world today, and we would project how long is it going to take for these countries to get to that, you know, official kind of tipping point where migration would then be reduced. If we look just at historical growth rates in these countries, with the most optimistic projections of historical growth plus an additional 2%, we're already looking at 2050 before we would see countries coming over that curve. With a still optimistic but slightly less projection, we would see this closer to 2100. And if we look at real historical growth rates, which would make the most sense, countries are not going to hit that until close to 2200. So we are looking at, you know, really a large time span out into the future to when we would actually expect development for many of these countries to practically reduce migration to any extent, but that's still probably going to be higher levels than we currently see today. So there's also starting to be more evidence around the effects of development aid on migration. And just for the sake of time, let me summarize some of this evidence for you. So aid in its current form does not seem to be effective enough to actually make real underlying changes that would affect migration decisions. So even where we do see that migration is having an effect, the magnitude is so low that you would need to see, you know, development interventions or development aid, you know, quadrupled or by 10 or 5 times as much as development aid currently is for there to be any real meaningful change with regard to numbers. For poor countries, really aid is expected to increase migration if having any effect at all. And a deterrent effect of aid only seems to be the case when higher levels of income are achieved or with very specific types of aid in very specific contexts. What does change often with development is how we perceive migrants and migration. But we do definitely need some more systematic evidence in the field. Some of this research is underway right now, but we would definitely like to see more. What we're also not seeing so far in a lot of the research is how development aid or development specifically affects irregular migration. So not migration in general, but irregular migration more specifically. And we'd also like to see more evidence around the disaggregation of different types of migrants too, and how aid might affect that. One very clear link, though, with development aid is we see a direct effect of migration on development spending in some cases. So we see, you know, within the European Union and many other countries that some countries are very clearly trying to spend money to deter migration. However, there's little evidence to back this up. So I think I'm going to stop there. Of course, there are a number of other common misconceptions and myths around migration, but I think this already gives you a good look at some of the big ones. Thanks.
This lecture was part of the EMN Educational Seminar on Migration entitled Migration in the Multilateral World. The seminar is organized by the International Organization for Migration Slovakia as the coordinator of the Slovak EMN National Contact Point. This activity is funded by the European Union and co-funded by the Ministry of Interior of the Slovak Republic. Thank you for listening.